Sometimes I lay under the moon.
Welcome to the Torah Teachers Roundtable, Apostolic Edition, with your hosts Rob Miller, Mark Patron, and yours truly, Mark Call. We hope you'll find this discussion entertaining, thought-provoking, and that above all, you'll be like the Bereans and search out the scriptures for yourself, see if these things be true. Good afternoon, folks, and welcome back once again. This is the Torah Teachers Roundtable, the Tanakh edition or flavor thereof. I'm your one of your three co-hosts here, Mark Call in Colorado, where we had a not incredibly unusual, but definitely a little bit unusual late season snowstorm. I know it's not snowing on the other side of the world where it's early in the morning, and Rob Miller is with us. And we also got Mark Patron online. We're talking about the book of 2 Kings, and last week we just started into chapter 3. Let me do a very quick recap of the verses there, and then we'll read from about verse 4 through 8. But it's about, at this point, a fellow named Jehoram, son of Ahab, who became king over Israel at Samaria. This, meanwhile, was the 18th year of Jehoshaphat, king of Judah in the south. And he reigned for 12 years. He did evil in the sight of Yahuwah, but not quite as bad as his dad did, because he at least put away a pillar of Baal that his father made. But nevertheless, he continued doing the same kind of nasty things. He didn't depart from the sins of Jeroboam, son of Nebat. Now we're told Misha, king of Moab, was a sheep breeder, and he regularly paid tribute to the king of Israel, 100,000 lambs, and the wool of 100,000 lambs, if I didn't pronounce that correctly, and the wool of 100,000 rams. But it happened when Ahab died that the king of Moab rebelled against the king of Israel. He decided he wasn't going to pay the tribute, evidently. And so Jehoram went out of Samaria at that time, and he mustered all of Israel. Then he went and he sent to Jehoshaphat, king of the south of Judah, and he said, "The king of Moab has rebelled against me. Will you go up with me to fight against Moab?" "Yep," he replied, "I will go up. I am as you are. My people are as your people. My horses as your horses." And then he asked the question, "Well, which way should we go up?" "Hey, by way of the wilderness of Edom," is the response, which takes us through verse 8, and we'll go to MP. Let him kind of kick things off at that point.
Yeah, here we go. Okay, so Mesha, he's the king of Moab. His name is derived from Yasha, which means safety, with a mem prefix. And what that means is from safety, which kind of tells you us the outcome of the coming battle. Mesha is leaving safety behind. So anyway, Mesha, the king of Moab, who's decided that 200,000 head of ovine herds a year was just a bit much, and unilaterally reneged on his deal with Ahab of Shomron, when Ahab croaked. Okay, so KJV's sheep master is translated from the word noked, which means to isolate a mark or to spot, which puts me in mind of branding cattle. That's pretty much what this guy did, I think. This was probably a lucrative business for him, but branding or spotting 200,000 head is also a lot of work. And he may have thought it was just wasn't worth the expense. This was right after the second monumental defeat for Shomron in battle in the last 3 years. So Mesha was probably counting on that making a difference. But Jehoram, king of Ahab, knew that this would be a pretty stunning economic blow for his kingdom. They had probably been getting this tribute for a number of years and built a part of their economy around it. So when he numbered Israel, he knew that victory was not a foregone conclusion. So Jehoram asked his father's ally, Jehoshaphat, if he would help to bring Moab back into compliance with its treaty with Israel. Meanwhile, Jehoshaphat, still wishing to bring Israel home to Yehuda's truer form of Yehovah worship, as well as under Yehuda's political hegemony, once again agreed to go to war alongside Israel. Now, either Jehoshaphat, still licking his wounds from going to Israel's aid against Syria, is not very quick on the uptake, or he actually did confer with Yehovah first via the Urim and Thummim. We're not told, but whatever was the actual case, Jehoshaphat's reply to Jehoram was nearly identical to his reply to Ahab. seemingly just the other day. We are Israel. I will go up against Moab with you, but by which route will we go? I mean, it wasn't even a question if he was going to go, but how were they going to get there? So Yehoram had probably war gamed this one out with his chiefs of staff and possibly had already sent messengers to received replies from Edom, of its aid in the fray as well, because that was his quick reply, by the way of the wilderness of Edom. Now, Edom dwelt around the south and west of the Salt Sea. So down the southwestern part of the Salt Sea, and they had about half of the very southern tip of it. Then they run up against Moab. So that's the geographical look of this thing, and that's what I got for verses 4 through 8. And you guys may now wax poetic.
Okay.
Or rhapsodic.
Well, I guess the only thing I would add in the first couple verses is just that we got a new king, and maybe it's time to test him as part of the logic, the calculus here, too. Rob, what are you thinking?
Well, what's amazing here is we've got Jehoshaphat that readily chimes in with his support, not asking for a prophet to prophesy where he had always had before.
Right, and it now, doesn't seem that way. That's true.
So readily he says, I'm with you all the way. Think of my people and horses as yours. And that just seems like a change. And I think, looking at the history of it, that things are getting that he's changing slowly by being associated with Israel. The people, we know the people at this time in Judah are becoming more idolatrous. Jehoshaphat seemingly isn't. He's holding true to the true religion. But there's something changing in him. Maybe his wariness is not as great as before. Maybe he trusts the house of Ahab more than he did before. I don't know. There's just something that has changed.
If I may, just for a minute, I don't remember him asking for a prophet to give him an idea of answering Ahav 3 years before either. So
he did initially, didn't he?
I don't think so. I think he did when he got to Ahav's place. He had already made arrangements to take his army with him.
Well,
but,
he
wanted to know what was going to be the outcome of the battle from a prophet of Yehovah. That's when they went and got, who was it, Obadiah, I think.
Mm. So you're saying that the affirmation of chiming in with him, he had
no
problem.
I think it was a foregone conclusion. I really think that Jehoshaphat was thinking about reuniting the two kingdoms again, and that was his goal. And I think that's what he was doing, personal.
Yeah, I think you're right, and I think that that's what the house of Ahab was thinking too. Except
absolutely, who was going to be the top king, though? Is the question,
right? And the northern tribes always thought that their might was greater than Judah's might just by sheer number. And they thought that they should be the dominant force. Definitely they were the richer of the two houses. But I think Judah, according to their campaigning, had been more successful in battle.
Yeah, I think so.
Than Israel. And but anyway, this just seems strange that Jehoshaphat is so willing to chime in so quickly, unless he is sure of the outcome himself, that Moab is a weaker army.
Yes.
and will be easily subdued. But now, it was interesting. I did want to make one point Nokad can be translated as owner of livestock. However, does the land support livestock? We know it would support sheep and goats, like the Bedouins normally have. But I don't know if it can support. I've been there. I don't know if it can support a great herd of cattle. It's pretty deserty.
Yeah. You're probably right. You know, goats will eat just about anything that they can get their mouths on. So
especially the type of goats that are there, and the type of sheep, because in Jordan, most of them raise Nubian sheep, which is which is a little goat like anyway, you know, and they will ferret out any sliver of vegetation and eat it.
Yeah, they are cute little critters, though.
They are, but I think all of the sheep family is cute.
Well, having had goats here for a while now, I can't help but agree that goats are cute too. So there you go. Yeah. But in any case,
the weird pupil just turns me a little bit strange. That's all. In their eye.
Oh, well, it's because it's kind of cat-like. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, it's a little bit strange, yeah.
Okay. Well, you get used to it, I guess I would say. In any case, after a while, they seem pretty cute when they look up at you with those great big eyes. So let's continue on, because what we have here is the next few verses after, which way are we going to go out? By the way of the wilderness, the king of Israel went with the king of Judah and the king of Edom. And they marched on that roundabout for 7 days. And there was no water for the army, nor for the animals that followed them. And at this point, verse 10 says, the king of Israel said, "Alas, for Yahuwah has called these three kings together to deliver them into the hand of Moab." But now it's Jehoshaphat who says, "Is there no prophet of Yahuwah here that we may inquire of Yahuwah by him?" So, and you know, it's funny to me, as I read this and we see almost the same words, here's my initial comment on it. We got a king asking almost the same question that seems to have gotten them in trouble before. And here, if they're not going to have Eliyahu to kick around anymore or to get kicked around by, we're going to go with his protege, Elisha. So that's the answer. One of the servants of the king of Israel answered. He said, "Elisha, the son of Shaphat, is here, who poured water on the hands of Eliyahu." So Jehoshaphat said, "Well, the word of Yahuwah is with him." So the king of Israel and Jehoshaphat, the king of Edom, went down to him. Let's pause there. MP, go ahead.
All right. Now, Jehoram and Jehoshaphat took the circuitous route on the western side of the Salt Sea, according to the Sacred Bridge Atlas at Bicarta, anyway, to meet up with the Edomi army and skirted the south end of the sea. So they went around the hills of Judea and then around the southern portion of southern tip of the Dead Sea. The big problem was a decided lack of H2O. The most important nutrient for mammalian existence is water. You know, you can live without food for a long time. You can live a couple of days without water. So poor planning. Perhaps there was a drought and the streams that had served David so well 200 years before were dry. Perhaps they took the longer route at the western foot of the Judean hills to thwart the lookouts on the hills of Moab. Maybe that was the case. Perhaps both, and maybe more. Maybe they went by an even further circuitous route. Anyway, whatever, they were getting a bit parched, and they needed a miracle to continue their mission. Azamra says this on the near end of the campaign. It says, "Campaigning in the arid wilderness areas east of the Dead Sea, these three kings almost lost their entire armies because they found no water." Now, obviously, Rabbi Greenbaum thought that they went east of the Salt Sea not considering that what the way of Edom was, which was the west side of the Salt Sea. So Zamir didn't get that quite right. But Moab controlled the entire eastern shore of the Dead Sea from the just south of the northern edge of the sea all the way around the southern edge. So not likely that they went on the east coast of the sea. So Yehoram's Hebrew exclamation is kind of funny to an English speaker. The word is translated alas in the King James, but the Hebrew word is aha, which is kind of interesting, you know, as he just discovered, like as if he just discovered something momentous, like maybe all three kings were going to die on a fool's errand. A Mark Whimsy on this particular thing, this is not a paraphrase, but a whimsy, says, we're going to be so dehydrated by the time we get there, Moab will not even need to raise a sword to destroy us. All they'll have to do is take a deep breath and blow our desiccated dust into the desert. That's what I think is coming up here. These guys are really getting thirsty. Now, fortunately, Jehoshaphat was thinking in a slightly different vein and asked if there wasn't a prophet of Jehovah around from whom they could inquire. Also, fortunately, one of Jehoram's servants was more in tune with the whereabouts of the prophets of Yah and told him that Elisha, the Talmid and confidant of Eliyahu, was there. So Zamra, on this turn of events, they said this. The situation was critical and was saved only by Elisha, who went with them not to join the battle, but because he had been ordered to do so prophetically in order to perform a miracle for Jehoram in a hope that it would bring him to repent, according to Radak on verse 11. At the height of the crisis, when Jehoshaphat, king of Yehuda, characteristically asked to consult a prophet, the servant of the king of Israel, who pointed out Elisha, described him as having poured out water over the hands of Eliyahu. Now, a servant who poured water on the hands was one who was especially trusted by his master. This was a guy who would be the chamberlain if he was serving a king, or whomever, trusted well enough to accompany him into the privy to wash the master's hands, among other things, after said master had relieved himself. So the TSK has a salient note on ancient Middle Eastern tradition of the one who poured water, and that is this. That is, was his constant and confidential servant, Mr. Hanway, speaking of a Persian supper to which he'd gone, says, supper being about brought in, a servant presented a basin of water and a napkin hung over his shoulders. He went to every one in the company and poured water on their hands to wash. Okay, so this is a trusted servant. Zamra also has a salient note. They said this. According to the Midrash, it was Elisha who had poured the water all around Eliyahu's altar on Mount Carmel in his contest with the prophets of Baal, back in 1 Kings 18. And his 10 fingers became like fountains filling the entire trench with water. That's according to Rashi and Radak on 2 Kings 3:11. Now, Jehoshaphat, in verse 12, recognized who Eliyashua was by his reputation, having never actually met him to our knowledge. He knew that this one would make inquiry of Jehovah and said, the word of Jehovah is with him. And just who is the word of Jehovah? The Ruach of Jehovah was on Elisha. That's the issue here. And Jehoshaphat knows it, and he's very happy to have him around. And that's what I got in verses 9 through 12. So you guys may wax rhapsodic if you'd like. Hello?
Well, the Midrash of this happening on Mount Carmel with the pouring of the water over Eliyahu's hands and his fingers becoming like springs of water until the ditch filled up, and it's fitting for a miracle to be performed for us through him concerning the water. I think that they thought because of this legend that was happening in his own time, of the fingers of Elijah becoming like fountains because Elisha had poured this water on them, right, was something that they were going to try to bank the future of their army on. Now, they're poised for battle. It's not like they're on their way to the battle. They're already poised for battle against the Moabites when they run out of water. And they become faint with thirst, and because there's not a drop of water in the whole valley. And it looked as though the vast armies of the three kings would suffer a great disaster. I think that at this time, the streams are usually, the wadis are usually running. But there must have been a drought, and so when they got there, they had expected to find the streams running, and they were dry, and that must have been a shock to the commanders and the kings, because I can't think that you would head out to battle in a desert without making preparations. That seems awfully irresponsible. So they must have this must have been taken for granted that these streams would be full of water. And when they got there, they weren't. Interesting. Shall we go on?
Yes, let's do that. And you're right. Otherwise, you'd have to ask that question. How could they be so careless?
Yeah. The whole outcome of two nations are involved here. And you're getting there and you don't have any provisions for your soldiers. In that day and age, mutiny was a reality. And the men were not above rising up and killing the king.
I am tempted to think that things haven't changed all that much.
Yeah.
Okay. Shall we continue on? We've only got about a minute until we get to the bottom of the hour break. So we have the multiple kings essentially saying, "Let's go find a prophet." And here comes. They go down to see Elisha, and he says,
"Yeah,
go ahead."
They're focused in mind because of this miracle legend that Elisha's their man. We need to go see him.
Okay, so they go. And, that's where we're going to end up at the break because he says, "What have I to do with you? Go to the prophets of your father and the prophets of your mother." But the king of Israel said to him, "No, for Yahuwah has called these three kings together to deliver them into the hand of Moab." And we got a whole minute, I think.
Don't you think it's interesting that he singles out the mother? Go to your mother's prophet. And to me, that sounds like a slam at Jehoram.
Yeah, that's how I think he was letting have it, was Jehoram.
Yeah, I think that he was. Of course, the house of Ahab was the hardest against Eliyahu, and so I think Elisha probably has it out for the house of Ahab. He doesn't like them, but he's a lot more diplomatic than Eliyahu was. We know that.
Yeah.
But it sounds like to me that he's saying, why don't you go to the prophets of Baal and inquire of them.
All right, well, there's some music, and we'll pick it up there with the Why response after we get back.
Sometimes in my tears I drown, but I never let it get me down. So when negativity surrounds, I know something it'll all turn around, because all my life I've been waiting for, I've been praying for the people to say that we don't want to fight no more. There'll be no more war, and our children will pay. One man, one way, one
Do-do-do-dum, do-be-do-dum-dum. Dum. Come a come a dum, do-be-do-dum-dum. Dum. Come a come a dum, do-be-do-dum-dum. Dum. Keeping Torah's a joy to do. Let's say that I, bound by the law, the 613 and many more. Don't they know what's really true? Yeshua died for me and you. I keep the peace and Shabbos too. 6,000 years old, it's not.
All right, welcome back now to the second half of the first hour of the Torah Teachers Roundtable, and towards the end of the book of 2 Kings, chapter 3, where we have some kings coming to Elisha, and he is fixing to give them a response after a query, you know, what's going to happen here. And Elisha says to them, "As Yahuwah Zebuoth lives, before whom I stand, surely, were it not that I regard the presence of Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, I wouldn't look at you, nor see you." So we kind of went to the place before the break that he doesn't seem to be a big fan of the northern king, if you will, and his whole family, for that matter. So he says, "Bring me a musician." Then it happened, when the musician played, that the hand of Yahuwah came upon him. And he said, "Thus says Yahuwah, make the valley full of ditches." So dig a bunch of ditches. "For thus says Yahuwah, you shall not see wind, nor shall you see rain, yet that valley shall be filled with water, so that you, your cattle, and your animals may drink. And this is a simple matter," he said, "in the sight of Yahuwah. He will also deliver the Moabites into your hand." Now let's pause there. And I know MP has some comments. He wants to pick it up basically with where we ended off at the break. So go ahead, Mark.
Alrighty. Yeah, Yehoram ben Ahav, king of Israel, Jehoshaphat, king of Yehuda, and the king of Moab, whatever his name was, came to Elishua, who said to Yehoram, in a Mark paraphrase, "Are you sure you came to the right place? I'm not the guy you want. Where are the prophets of your father and your mother's gods?" Yehoram said in another Mark paraphrase, "Yehovah has delivered us into Moab's hands. He's brought us by a circuitous route where there was no H2O and no water, and we are all about to die because of it. Moab is going to clean our collective clocks unless Yehovah relieves our collective thirst soon." And that's really and truly what's going on. So Elisha said, in yet another Mark paraphrase, "As Yehovah Tzevaot lives, were it not for Jehoshaphat's presence with you, I'd have let you perish at Moab's hands. But in order to save him, you also have to be saved. More's the pity. Bring me a nagan." Nagan, by the way, is the Hebrew word is it talks about someone who preserves music or plays music from his memory. And according to TSK, it says this. "This was evidently intended to soothe and tranquilize the prophet's mind, which had been agitated and discomposed with holy indignation by the presence of the idolatrous king and the collection of his abomination, recollection of his abomination." The soothing influence of music is generally acknowledged to in every civilized nation. Now, yeah, Zamra seems, yeah. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, it certainly worked for David on Saul. That's probably the preeminent example in scripture.
It surely did. Zamra seems, and Stone Stanach's notes also seem to agree with the reason Elisha requested the Nagan, the musician. It said this, "Initially, Elisha did not want to even look at the sinful king of Israel. And in his anger, the spirit of prophecy left him. For wisdom and prophecy cannot dwell side by side with anger, according to Pesachim 66b. It was only when Elisha called for musicians to play joyous music that the spirit of prophecy dwelled with him again in verse 15, teaching that the Shekinah does not dwell through sadness and lethargy, but only through the joy of a mitzvah, as it is written, 'Take for me a musician.'" Just here, the Nagan, in Shavos 30 in verse B, or B. I think that it's very interesting that the Ortho-Jewish and the Christian commentators seem to be in full agreement. If a state of agitated anger can quench the spirit of Yehovah in one of his great prophets to the extent of being unable to perform his mission, how much more would it be true of us lesser men of Yehovah? Elishua is arguably the greatest miracle-working prophet of Yah until Yeshua himself. More miracles attributed to him than even to his father Eliyahu. Now, how many bona fide miracles of Yah can any of your hosts claim to have gone through, or have been done through their hands? Miracles have happened to me, or of that there is no doubt. But through me, I'm unaware of any. Okay? That's the commentary I have on verses 13 through 15. And I'll let you guys take it.
Okay, we'll see if Rob has anything he wants to add. He said, thinking he knew the answer.
Well, Elisha said to the king of Israel, "What do you and I have in common? Go consult your father's prophets and your mother's prophets." But the king of Israel answered him, "No, because Yahweh has called these three kings together to hand them over to Moab." And the Tosifta Yonatan paraphrases it like this: "Please don't mention the sins of that wicked woman. Beg mercy for us, for Yahweh has summoned us together." Now, Elisha said, "As Yahweh Zavaot lives, before whom I stand, if I didn't respect the fact that Jehoshaphat, the king of Yehuda, is here, I wouldn't even look in your direction or take notice of you. But now bring me a musician." Because of his anger, the Shekinah had left him. As the musician played, the hand of Yahweh fell on Elisha. And he said, "Yahweh says to dig until this valley is full of trenches or pits full of water. For here is what Yahweh says. You won't see wind, you won't see rain. Nevertheless, the valley will be filled with water, and you'll drink, you, your cattle, and your other animals. That's an easy thing to do from Yahweh's perspective. And furthermore, this miracle is slight and insignificant in the eyes of Yahweh, and he will proceed to act wondrously with you and perform another miracle, and he will deliver Moab into your hands, and he will also hand Moab over to you. You'll conquer every fortified city, every choice town. You'll chop down every good tree, stop up every well, ruin every good field with stones. The next morning, around the time for making the offering, water came from the direction of Edom." Interesting. It comes from the direction of Edom. "And the countryside was filled with water." So seeing the wicked Jehoram, who was following his father's footsteps and continued to spread Baal worship in his kingdom, Elisha rebuked him fearlessly.
Right.
Elisha told him to his face that if it wasn't for the king of Yehuda, he wouldn't even look at him. However, this was a rare opportunity to show them Yahweh's kindness to his people. And so Elisha told them, "In Yahweh's name, to dig pits or cisterns. And though they would see neither wind nor rain, the cisterns would be filled with pure drinking water for them and their horses. Moreover, Elisha promised them complete victory over the Moabites." And every word of Elisha came true. So this whole thing of they're doing this, he believes that Yahweh is smiling on them because of the king of Yehuda. Jehoshaphat was a righteous man. So I think it's interesting that Yahweh sends water from the direction of Edom, even though the Edomites are not good people. They're idolaters too. So only because of Yehuda, only because of Jehoshaphat and his righteousness is this miracle done. And I think that kind of catapults Jehoshaphat to the central figure in this battle.
Okay. Interesting.
Amen.
As you were speaking, Rob, I couldn't help but think that isn't it interesting too? And this is certainly a pattern we've seen, and I can't help but think it applies today as well. That you look out and ask, okay, how many righteous kings do we have here? Answer, one, and the others just happen to be hanging around the guy. So what else are we going to do? The creator of the universe essentially says, I'll go ahead and do this for the sake of the good ones, even though they're vastly outnumbered.
Mm-hmm.
Does, again, sound familiar?
It does.
Okay, MP, anything else before we move on?
Well, I'll cover verses 16 to 20. Have we read that far? I think we have.
I read through the end of the prophecy up until what happened. So it happened in the morning is verse 20 where we're at.
Okay, and it came to pass in the morning when the meat offering was offered, that behold, there came water by way of Edom, and the country was filled with water. Yeah, we did read that. Okay, so no sooner did the Nagan, that is the musician, strum his harp, or whatever it was that he did to praise Yehovah, then the Ruach welled up in him, inspiring him as in Eliyahu, Elisha, inspiring him to command the armies to dig ditches or pools in the valley. The King James says ditches. This would be the Rift Valley, I think, at the southern end of the Salt Sea. There would be only one way the Moavi would retreat in the ensuing battle, at least until they cleared the southern end of the sea, and that would be east through the three armies' hosts, okay? Or through the three armies' hosts. So after Elisha gave the order to dig the pools, he also gave the reason. Yehovah was about to perform a miracle that would fool Moab into thinking that they could win without any expense, physical or material. Israel would not get rained on or even feel a cooling breeze, but the land would fill with water to more than cover their need. I assume that Israel did not dig any ditches until after sunset due to Moab's response in verses 21 to 23, which we'll discuss in a bit. The allies would be able to water themselves and their livestock and get some rest before the battle. There would be no clue to the Moavi that the allies had had any respite, but the allies got the word of Yehovah from Elishua that they would be victorious and wreak havoc on Moab, both in battle and over their livelihood, spoiling both waterholes and the very cropland, making them virtually dependent for their lives on the allies. Such was the promise of Yehovah to all three nations. Azamra says this, the true prophet thus flows with the waters of Torah, and in Elisha's merit, Elohim miraculously filled the dry valley in the wilderness of Edom with wells brimming with water. And in verse 20, Yehovah filled those ditches and pools with water, I assume by seepage, to satisfy the needs of the allies and their livestock, but perhaps more importantly, to fool Moab into not attacking the allies. Will it bring repentance to Yehoram? Would it bring Edom to belief in Yehovah? It should, but don't hold your breath. That's what I got through verse 20.
Okay. Okay. Rob?
Well, I said that Yehoram was wicked because he followed in his father's footsteps, and he continued to spread the Baal worship in his kingdom. Thinking about this, he did put away the Baalim. The accusation is actually that he just continued in the sins of Yeroboam, which is a lot less than the sin of Ahab, who allowed Baal worship and Asherah worship to actually take precedent over Yahweh worship. So I think that accusation is a little bit harsh towards Yehoram. I think that he sees himself as purifying the kingdom of Israel of pagan worship and getting back to the original work, worship of Yeroboam. And Yeroboam saw himself as reforming the religion of Yehuda and getting rid of the personality worship of the house of David. I think that's a lot different. And if that is true, you can see why there's not so much trepidation on Jehoshaphat's part of throwing his destiny in with Yehoram. But anyway, if that's the case, Elisha still considers the house of Ahab as a wicked entity that is the corrupter of Israel. Or paraphrasing the Democrats, we can call him the corrupter in chief. Anyway, I think that something is going on here with Elisha and with Yahweh. It's as though that he wants to show himself again to Israel as the only Elohim. Besides me, there is no other.
Right.
And so if this miracle is seen as a Yahweh only miracle, that it will cause a teshuvah upon the part of the armies of Israel. I don't know. Miracles tend to impress people, but rarely does it cause repentance. Generally, calamity is the only thing that does that. So I think that Yahweh is working on behalf of Jehoshaphat and his army. And if we can get some to repent in the house of Israel, that's good too. But I think Yahweh's not banking on that. I think he's just doing it for his namesake with the house of Yehuda. Because right now, where goes Israel goes Yehuda and Edom for that matter. So I think that this is done on behalf of Jehoshaphat and Yehuda.
Okay, well, let's continue with the story then, and we'll see how it plays out. So, I don't think we actually read this. I know we've talked about it already, but I'll read it and then we'll continue on. They rose up early in the morning. The sun was shining on the water, and the Moabites saw the water. And on the other side, it was as red as blood. And they said, "This is blood. Kings have surely struck swords and have killed one another. Now, therefore, Moab, to the spoil." So, go in and get what's left over. Get the goodies. So when they came to the camp of Israel, Israel rose up and attacked the Moabites so that they fled before them. And they entered their land, then killing the Moabites. And they destroyed the cities, and each man threw a stone on every good piece of land and filled it. They stopped up all the springs of water and cut down all the good trees, but they left the stones of Kir Hareset intact. However, the slingers surrounded and attacked it. Shall we pause there?
Yeah, that'll be fine. Okay, let me hit on 21 to 25. In verse 21, Moab saw the allies' encampment. They swiftly armed themselves for battle. But as the sun rose, and the redness of the refracted sunlight back to them in the morning, they mistook the water for blood in verse 23 and decided to go loot the camp of the armies that had obviously come all that way only to fight and kill each other. What a stroke of luck, they must have thought. It was possible that they were so sure that the allies were all dead that many, if not all, didn't even carry their weapons with them. They said, "To the spoil." Okay, so they didn't even carry their weapons with them, so that they could carry away more spoils. Stone Tanakh has a good comment on verse 22. It says, since that area had always been an arid ravine, it never dawned on the Moavi that they were looking at a reflection from water, and that from Rashi. Now, verse 24 reinforces the idea to me that the Moavi didn't even carry their weapons with them. It says, and they said, this blood, the kings are surely slain, Moab to the spoil. Okay, just go and get it. So that tells me that they didn't carry anything but themselves, and they were going to carry everything back with them. So Moab just, they didn't even carry their weapons with them. Because when the Allied armies came out of their hidey holes to do battle, Moab just turned tail and ran. They couldn't fight because they were unarmed. Their only chance was to outrun the armed pursuers. So in verse 25, it says that the Allies decimated Moab, possibly literally leaving only one in ten alive. They tore down every defensive wall of every city that they came to. They took the stones from the city walls and strewed them in every decent field for crops. They filled in every water well with the stones. They cut down every useful tree, and the only thing of the walls that was left in place was the mortar. KJV has Kir Hareset, which I am sure they mistook for the city, Kir, to limit space or to wall off, can mean city, of Hareset. Now, Hareset is from the root haras, which means to scrape or to smooth. So Stones Tanakh translates the word mortar. The Allies tore down the city walls of the Moavi capital, leaving only the mortar, while strewing the stones everywhere they could be made impediments to agriculture. Then they brought in the slingers, that is the artillery, from the hand sling like David's, which was powerful enough that David's stone sunk into Goliath's skull, as well as catapults that could send some of the larger stones from this city's walls to tear down what was left of its mortar. The city's walls were leveled by the time that the Allies were finished. Okay, that's through the end of verse 25, and I've got about that much more on 26 and 27. Go ahead and wax rhapsodic on.
Okay, well, we will wax briefly rhapsodic, and I'll remind Rob we're less than a minute away from the break. So, can we do it, Rob, or not?
Well, sure.
Okay.
So we have this perplexion. When all of Moab heard that the kings had come to attack them, every man was summoned, from the youngest capable of bearing arms to the older ones, and stationed on the border. They rose up early in the morning when the sun was shining on the water. Moab, when they saw the water in the distance, looking as red as blood, said, "That's blood. The kings must have quarreled, and their soldiers killed themselves. Moab is to plunder." So this kind of happenstance, it reminds you of a Gideonite type of miracle here, that they've seen this reflection and mistook it for blood, and it's creepy, but they think, aha, the victory is ours. It's, we can plunder. So that causes them to make wrong decisions.
All right. Well, we have a right decision to make, and that's to take a quick break here. This is coming up top of the hour, and we'll be back after that. I am here for a reason. Sometimes in my tears I drown, but I never let it get me down. So when negativity surrounds, I know someday it'll all turn around, because all my life I've been waiting for, I've been praying for the people to say that we don't want to fight no more. There'll be no more war, and our children will pay. Sometimes I let Welcome to the Torah Teachers Roundtable, Apostolic Edition, with your hosts Rob Miller, Mark Patron, and yours truly, Mark Call. We hope you'll find this discussion entertaining, thought-provoking, and that above all, you'll be like the Bereans and search out the scriptures for yourself and see if these things be true.
I know someday it'll all turn around because all my life I've been waiting for, I've been praying for the people to say that we don't want to fight no more. There'll be no more and our children will pay.
All right, we are back now, the second half of the Torah Teachers Roundtable Tanakh edition for today. We're finishing up Chapter 3 and the story of the attack that, well, is almost but not quite over at this point, where the king of Moab has been essentially tricked. And as we went to break, the cities have been destroyed. Basically, men threw a stone on every good piece of ground and filled it. They stopped up the springs. And let me read the last couple verses here. Then we'll go to Rob. We'll finish up the chapter. When the king of Moab saw that the battle was too fierce for him, he took with him 700 men who drew the sword to break through to the king of Edom, but they could not. And then he took his eldest son, who would have reigned in his place, and literally offered him, it says, as a burnt offering upon the wall. And there was great indignation against Israel. So they departed from him and returned to their own land. So, Rob, let's pause there. That takes us to the end of the chapter, the end of this saga. And I'll let you kind of continue where you were, and we'll wrap things up on the battle.
Well, when all the Moabites had heard that the kings were come up to fight against them, they gathered all that were able. The muster of the troops had long preceded the storm. They gathered all that were able to put on armor. Literally, there had been gathered together all that girded themselves up with girdles. All the male population, in other words, a full age, a full fighting age, had come up. And they had arrayed themselves in their armor. And they're positioning themselves on the extreme border of the territory, which is at the Wadi el-Ashay. So looked at the reflection of the water, the red color of the water is because of the red dirt of Edom stirred up because of the freshly dug trenches or pits. But Josephus tends to say it was the red hue of the sunrise. Whatever it was, it was because of this color that a misconception was made.
That's right.
They're seeing on the opposite side what appears to be running blood. And when they saw the water in the distance looking as red as blood, they said, that's blood. The kings have quarreled and their soldiers killed each other. Now, there were rivalries and jealousies between Judah, Israel, and Edom, which made it quite possible that any time a quarrel might break out among them. So this sounded reasonable.
Yeah, it was plausible.
Well, in Edom especially was.
Absolutely.
It was probable. A reluctant member of the Confederacy forced to take part in it by, by force, I mean by pressure. The Moabites, moreover, had recently had personal experience how easily the swords of the Confederates might be turned against each other since their last expedition against Judah in 2 Chronicles 21 through 25 had completely failed through such a disagreement and contention. So now they think, well, it's ours to win. Let's take the spoil. If their supposition was correct and the kings had come to blows and the hosts destroyed each other, Moab would have nothing to do but to take up the spoil.
That's
and
right.
Strip the slain and plunder the camps of the Confederates. A disorderly rush took place for this purpose. It was, I liken it to maybe the Oklahoma Homestead Rush or the Gold Rush of California, everybody just heading for what they thought would be plunder.
Right, right.
And instead, what happens? when they arrived at the camp of Israel, Israel launched an attack so that Moab fled before them. Because I would imagine they didn't even take their weapons. They wanted to be as light as they could, and they're all running down towards the wadi to take up the spoil. So they don't want anything in their hand. They need to fill their hand with plunder. So they go running with no armor, no weapons, and they run towards Israel, and Israel attacks. So all they could do was hightail it and retreat. But they advanced on Moab, and they struck them, and they made ruins of the cities. Each man threw his stone on every good field covering it, and they stopped up the wells. They chopped down all the good trees. Finally, all that remained was Kir Hareset behind its stone wall, with the slinger surrounding it and attacking it. When the king of Moab saw that the fighting was too much for him, he took with him 700 armed men with swords and tried to break through to the king of Edom, but they couldn't do it. Then he took his firstborn son, who was to have succeeded him as king, and offered him as a burnt offering on the wall. Following this, such great anger came upon Israel that they left him and went back to their own land. So, can you imagine? Here he takes the crown prince and he roasts him on the wall. And that sobered the fighting passions of Israel. And they were disgusted and they just said, let's go. Let's get out of here. And now, what I think is interesting too is, you know, there's a commandment in Torah not to cut down the trees. That's a sin. But here,
there's a commandment to cut them down. Yeah.
Yahweh overrides that. Now, one could make the argument that Yahweh's talking about don't cut down the trees in Israel, in the land. But it's always been understood by the rabbis you're not to cut down any tree of size. Because, just think about it, it makes common sense. It cuts down erosion. It makes the land healthy, and it gives shade. So trees are a win for everybody, and that's why to this very day, the greatest thing you can do in the land is to plant a tree.
Yeah. Now, in fairness, I guess I do have to mention, if I'm remembering right, and I don't have the verses sitting here in front of me, there were some trees that you could cut down and others that you couldn't, and the distinction was a fruit tree, if I'm remembering right.
No, it just seems anyway.
Even in the land, yeah.
Yeah, it's a harsh act to cut a tree.
No doubt about it. But on the other hand, yeah, it's not quite as much of a prohibition as the rabbis might suggest, is what I'm trying to point out.
Could be, but next to killing a man, cutting down a tree is a major offense to Yahweh, is the way it's always been presented. And again, that's why they always plant trees, for honor, both for the honor of the dead and for the honor of Yahweh. When they, like I said, to this day, they plant trees, in the land, considering it a great honor for you to do that. So with this happening, this is making a big statement to all the nations around about. And this is, I think, this is what causes the Assyrian leadership to take notice and decide they need to do something with Israel and Yehuda before it gets out of hand. They need to make a move. And so I think that this, beyond anything else, is a wake-up call to the Assyrian leadership that they're going to need to make a move towards Israel. And we'll see that in the coming years.
Okay. Well, that takes us to the end of the chapter. Unless MP has some more.
I have some, yeah.
Okay. So go ahead.
I'm not quite finished with it yet. In verses 26 and 27, Mesha, the Moabi king, understood that he was no longer king and hightailed it with his 700 closest secret servicemen and tried to break through to his nearest neighbor, that is the Edomi king. But they were not able to get to him. He was probably trying to get to the Edomi to convince him that he'd be better off allied with Moab than with Israel or Yehuda. But Edom is more closely related to Israel than to Moab, who was not even of Abrahamic parentage, okay? He's descended from Haran through Lot, Abi's nephew. Okay, so yeah. They may not have been close kin, but they were what's called kith and kin, some distant blood relation between second or beyond second or third cousins.
Hey, okay, Mark.
Now, yes.
Do you think that, you know, he knows he needs to surrender, and it kind of reminds me of the Germans trying to get to the Americans before the Russians, they knew that the Americans would treat them better, and the Americans were by and large of Germanic heritage, as opposed to the Russians. And
Saxon heritage for sure.
Yeah. So I think he's saying, hey, let's get to our cousins and surrender to them. They'll treat us a lot better. Plus, I think he was hoping that he could maybe change him or to sway him to their side, because after all, they're cousins.
Right.
And I don't know. I when you were talking, I thought this sounds very much like I need to choose the lesser of the evils to surrender to, and I think our cousins are it.
That's exactly my thinking. Uh-huh. He wanted to get to first of all, it's his nearest neighbor. Okay.
Yes.
The Moabi and the Edomi were very close neighbors, and they probably had been allies.
I would assume so. They always seem to be in scripture in the past. They allied themselves against Israel against Israel in David's day. And
right.
So, I think this is a choice of who do I surrender to? I'm going to surrender to our cousins.
Right. Much closer cousins anyway. All right.
Sorry for interrupting.
That's okay. That was good. Okay, so they're distant blood relations, something like second cousin, kith and kin is what I said. Now, having failed to get to the Edomi king to attempt a rapprochement, he took his, that is, the Edomi king's eldest son, his crown prince, as it were, and offered him on the wall of the city. Now, this is, as the King James reads, it looks like the Moabi king offered his own son. But if you look at it, it kind of fits that he went to the Edomi king and he may have had the kid, the crown prince, as a prisoner already.
Mm.
Okay. So that's where I'm coming from on this. He offered him on the wall of the city to Chemosh, that is Mesha's god. Now, Stone Tanakh has a good note concerning this. It says, Mesha slew the firstborn of the Edomi king, whom he had apparently captured, and for whom sake the Edomi joined Israel against Moab. And the Edomi were furious with their erstwhile Israelite allies for not having prevented this barbaric murder, according to Radak. And this caused a rift between Yehuda and Edom as well. Then the tide of war turned suddenly against the Israeli army, and they abandoned the siege. TSK has a different take on the same passage, and it says this. In cases of greatest extremity, it was customary in various heathen nations to offer human sacrifices, and even their own children. This was frequently done among the Phoenicians, the Greeks, the Romans, the Scythians, the Gauls, the Africans, and others. and it was a natural fruit of a religious system, which had for the objects of its worship cruel and merciless divinities. Now, the king of Moab, in this case, sacrificed his son to obtain the favor of Chemosh, his god, who, being a devil, delighted in blood and murder and the destruction of mankind. The dearer anything was to them, the more acceptable those idolaters thought the sacrifice, and therefore burnt their children in the fire to their honor. And so I can see where either one of these can be correct, okay? Either he's got the Edomi son, king's son, or he sacrificed his own. It could go either way. Now, Azamra's take is actually closer to the Christian archaeologists than from TSK, and it says, confronted with miracle after miracle performed by God in favor of the Israelites, the king of Moab turned to his astrologers and asked them what was the secret of Israelite success. When they told him that it was the first patriarch Abraham that had been willing to sacrifice his very son to Elohim, the Moabite king took his firstborn son and offered him up Al-Hachoma in verse 27. This is literally translated as on the wall. But since the word Choma is spelled here without the letter Vav, it can be read as Chama, the sun. We learn that the sacrifice was to the sun god whom the Moabites worshipped, according to Rashi and Radak in Sanhedrin 39b. Now, the king of Moab's sacrifice caused great anger against Israel in verse 27, because they too had taken to worshiping idols and no longer showed the same willingness to sacrifice all for God as had Abraham. Some have compared the Moabite king's willingness to slaughter his firstborn son for the sake of victory to the jihadi willingness to send out suicide bombers in all directions. However, the comparison is not quite accurate, as research indicates that the typical profile of the suicide bomber is one of a chronic depressive social reject who has very little to lose by giving up his life for the sake of 72 virgins in paradise. Nevertheless, the lesson Israel should learn from the suicide bombers is that the way to dissipate God's great anger is not by throwing away our lives in an orgy of destruction, but by heroically offering all our strength and vitality on the altar of God's service every day. And that's what Azamra has to say, and I agree with that entirely, wholeheartedly. I think that's a wonderful exhortation to us, and that's what I got for this chapter.
Okay. MP? Or Rob?
No, I think that, personally, I think when they saw that act, killing the crown prince on the wall, roasting, you know, a man alive. I think that that was disgusting.
I tend to think, yeah, you know, with all due respect, MP, I'm not quite willing to go with the other understanding either. There doesn't quite have that ring of truth, if you will.
Not to try to beleaguer the point, but I just think that this was such a horrific act for the Israelites that someone would do that to their own firstborn, and it being a royal, that was just disgusting, and they just said, okay, you know, let's leave this city to itself. We don't need it. We don't want it.
You could have this place. Yeah. We've had
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah.
We're out of here. Okay.
Yeah. It just wasn't worth fighting for. These, you know, some things are worth fighting for. This ain't it.
Okay. So are we finished? Let's continue with chapter 4. I'll read the first few verses. This is one of those stories that I think most people are going to remember. It's a pretty famous story about the prophet Elijah, what he's going to do next, and a widow. And it says this: a certain woman of the wives of the sons of the prophets cried out to Elisha, saying, "Your servant, my husband, is dead, and you know that your servant feared Yahuwah. And the creditor is coming to take my two sons to be his slaves. So Elisha said to her, well, what shall I do for you? Tell me, what do you have in the house? And she said, your maidservant has nothing in the house but a jar of oil. And then he responded, go, borrow vessels from everywhere, from all your neighbors, empty vessels. Do not gather just a few. In other words, go out and get your hands on everything you can possibly get that'll hold liquid. And don't get just a few, get a whole bunch of them. And when you have come in, you shall shut the door behind you and your sons. Then pour it into all of those vessels and set aside the full ones. So she went and did what she was told. She went from him and shut the door behind her and her sons, who brought the vessels to her, and she poured it out. Let me go and read the rest of the story. It's a little bit longer than we usually would, but what the heck. It came to pass then, when the vessels were full, that she said to her son, bring me another vessel. He said to her, there ain't any more. We're out. That's it. So at that point, the flow of oil ceased. And then she came and told the man of Elohim, and he said, go, sell the oil and pay your debt, and you and your sons live on the rest. All right, MP, let's go to you first. I know, okay. Say what?
Oh, yeah, no, let's go ahead.
Okay.
I haven't got a whole lot to share with you on this, but here we go.
Well, that's why I figured we'd start. Yeah, you can kick us off.
So what does Torah say about this whole thing? Let me read that again, verse 1. Now there cried a certain woman of the wives of the sons of the prophets unto Elisha, saying, thy servant, my husband is dead, and thou knowest that thy servant did fear Elohim, and the creditor is come to take unto him my two sons to be bondmen. Okay, well, what does Torah say about this? If a man dies and owes a debt, can his sons be made bondservants to be to the creditor? Does Torah address this issue? Now, I looked, and the only place I could find that addressed it at all was in Leviticus 25, 39 to 43, where it says, and if thy brother be by thee be waxen poor and be sold unto thee, thou shalt not compel him to serve as a bondservant. As an hired servant, as a sojourner, he shall be with thee, shall serve thee unto the year of Yovel, and shall he depart from thee, he and his children with him, and shall return into his own family, and unto the possession of his fathers shall he return, for they are my servants, which I brought forth out of the land of Egypt. They shall not be sold as bondmen. Thou shalt not rule over him with rigor, but with fear, but you shall fear your Elohim. Now, it seems that the longest one can take a son of a debtor into servitude is 49 years, assuming that the debtor got the loan on the day following the Yovel and died the day after that. If the Yovel begins a week after the debt was entered into, that would be as long as the creditor could have their service. No Israeli was to be a bondservant to another Israeli. Okay? You were not sold into any kind of slavery. If you went and sold your services to the guy until the Yovel year or until the debt was paid off, that was it. You went and you worked like a hired hand. He took care of you. He had a place for you to stay. He fed you. All right? you were a hired hand is basically what you were. And you worked for that hire until such time as your debt was paid off. And that's the way it's supposed to be. Now here's this guy is going to take the sons of the man who was the debtor, and he's going to take those two sons and he's going to make them bond servants. And it doesn't say if he's going to let them go even at the Yovel year. I got to wonder about this. I don't think this is a Torah, and I'm going to. And that's really all I've got on chapter 4 at this point.
Okay. That's a good point, MP. The only thing I can add is we don't know what the contract might have been, whether the sons were part of the deal or not. And meanwhile, we're at the break, so we'll pick it up there.
Don't take me soon, because I am here for a reason. Sometimes in my tears I drown, but I never let it get me down. So when negativity surrounds, I know someday it'll all turn around, because people just say that we don't wanna fight no more. There'll be no more war, and our children will pay.
Do-do-do-dum-do-be-do-dum-dum. Come-a-come-a-dum-do-be-do-dum-dum. Come-a-come-a-dum-do-be-do-dum-dum. Keepin' Torah's a joy to do. Let's say that line bound by the law, the 613 and many more. Don't they know what's really true? Yeshua died for me and you. I keep the peace and Shabbos too. 6,000 years old, it's not.
All right, we are back now, the last segment of the show for today, Torah Teachers Roundtable, and talking about, at this point, Chapter 4 in the story of Elisha, one of the first of several miracles that we're going to see here, where he has a widow who has two sons, there's a debt issue, and he tells her, go out and get a hold of every single jar you can. All she's got is one little carafe of oil. And literally, she brings them all home, pours it out until she runs out of places to put it, and he tells her, go sell the oil and pay your debt, and you and your sons live on the rest. Now, a couple of things here, I guess. One, and I haven't looked up the Hebrew word here, but I think it's a reasonable assumption to make, and it may be that it comes from the grammar or the language, that this is olive oil, and it's probably very good olive oil. We're not told any of that, but obviously it's worth quite a bit of money. It's enough that it solves their issues. And certainly when it comes to, I guess you'd say, prophetic issues that kind of speak to us from other places in Scripture, you know, whether it's her cup that runneth over, or the idea of oil and things that are used for anointing, and of course, we look ahead and we see references to the 10 virgins and oil for lamps. So many things that this can point to that it almost boggles the mind, I guess. So Rob, let me go to you. What's on your mind with respect to all of this?
Let me read it again. The wife of one of the gilded prophets complained to Elisha, "Your servant, my husband, died," she said, "and you know that he feared Yahweh. Now a creditor has come to take my two children as his slaves." Elisha asked her, "What should I do for you? Tell me what to do. What do you have in the house?" And she answered, "Your servant has nothing in the house but a flask of oil." And then she said, "Go and borrow containers from all your neighbors. Empty the containers and don't borrow just a few. Then go in, shut the door with you and your son inside. Pour oil into all the containers, and as they are filled, put them aside." So she left him and shut the door on herself and her son, and they brought her the containers while she poured. When the containers were full, she said to her son, "Bring me another container." But he answered, "There isn't another container." Then the oil stopped flowing. She came and told the man of Elohim, and he said, "Go sell the oil, pay your debts, then you and your son can live on what's left." So one day, the widow of the prophet Obadiah came to Elisha in a voice of grief. She told him that her husband died in great indebtedness, and the creditors now threatened to take away her sons as slaves unless she paid the debt immediately. Elisha had known the Yah-fearing and kind Obadiah, who under the very eyes of the wicked King Ahab fed and sheltered the true prophets of Yahweh, whom the wicked Queen Isabel sought to exterminate. He sustained them at his own expense, and when his own means gave out, he had to incur many debts. Now his two sons were to have to serve the creditor to the full value of the debts, for such was the law of those days. Surely such a man deserves a better lot. "What have you in the house?" Elisha asked her. "I have nothing but a little pot of oil," she replied. "Good. Now go and borrow many vessels from all your neighbors, the more the better. Then shut yourself in your sons and pour the oil into the vessels." The woman followed the prophet's instructions. When she began to pour out some of the oil into the first vessel, the oil kept on pouring until the vessel was full. The boys passed her the next vessel, and this too soon became full of oil. Vessel after vessel was thus filled with oil, and the little oil that was originally in the pot never seemed to end. When all the vessels were filled, She cried to the boys to pass her another vessel, but there was no other vessel. Immediately the oil stopped. So the woman ran to Elisha and told him what happened. Elisha was not surprised. He told her to sell all the oil and repay her husband's debts and use the rest to support her and her children. This is very reminiscent of the miracle of Elijah and the oil and the flour that was used to feed him, and it never gave out with the widow and her son. So this seems to be a fulfillment of that miracle. Remember, Elisha wants to receive a double portion. And so this miracle seems a little bit greater than the miracle for the widow and her son. This one is done for Yahweh's namesake, being that this is Obadiah's widow, or according to the Midrash, it's Obadiah's widow. So this is a very an amazing occurrence, because this is Yahweh's man that has incurred the debt on Yahweh's behalf. And so Yahweh pays the debt by doing the miracle. That's the way I see it. Sorry about the banging of the door. There's a storm blowing in. And it seems to have...
I was hoping that was you or Mark.
Yeah, it was me. There's a major storm blowing in. You can hear the wind chimes going crazy and the door slamming. So yeah. Kind of interesting.
Yeah, we had. I'm sorry. I gotta get off on a tangent here. Yesterday, we went out to a wedding. A friend of ours, a daughter of a friend of ours, got married, and it was a 4-hour drive down and a 4-hour drive back, and we were about 4 hours there. But anyway, the storm. As the festivities were about to begin, a little rain started to fall. And there was a forecast for a really bad storm in Columbus, Ohio, which was about 60 miles north of where we were at. And so the master of ceremonies, who was from Hayovel ministry, stopped everything, and he says, "Hey, wait a minute, we got to pray for this, right? Feel this rain coming? We got to pray for this." And he prayed that the storm would miss us, right? Well, we had little bits of drops falling, but the wedding went on without a hitch, just a few drops of rain here and there and a little bit of wind. But in the meanwhile, when the whole thing was over, we found out that those storms had literally skirted around us. So when you've got something like that coming, remember, pray. Yahweh will take care of you, okay? And it turned out being a wonderful wedding. So anyway, sorry for the digression, but I had to say that because... It was just so cool.
Okay. Do you have any more comment on the story of the oil, or are we finished on all that?
What's interesting is that the word that's translated pot there is asuk, which means to separate, and the word that's translated oil is shemen, or shaman, would be the root, and that's to nourish. Okay, so the oil is nourish. So you're has something to do with this whole story. The fact that those two words are used in conjunction, okay, that Yah is going to take care of this woman and her family by separating her and feeding them, okay, is the way that I see at least those two words working in there. And that's very cool to me as well.
Okay. All right, well, let's continue. So we have another miracle that's going to happen in the next few verses. Verse 8 says, "Now it happened one day, Elisha went to Shunem, where there was a notable woman, and she persuaded him to eat some food. So it was, as often as he passed by, he would turn in there to eat some food. And then she said to her husband, 'Look now, I know that this is a set-apart, a kadosh man of Elohim who passes by us regularly. So, please, let's make a small upper room on the wall. Let us put a bed there for him, and a table and a chair and a lampstand. So it'll be that whenever he comes to us, he can turn in here. So he'll have a place where he comes to town, he can spend the night.' And it happened one day that he came there, and he turned in the upper room, and he lay down there. And then he said to Gehazi, his servant, call this Shunammite woman. And when he had called her, she stood before him. And he said to her, say now to her, said to his servant at this point, said to him, say now to her, look, you've been concerned for us with all this care. What can I do for you? Do you want me to speak on your behalf to the king or to the commander of the army? And she answered, I dwell among my own people. Well, so he said, what then is to be done for her? And Gehazi answered, actually, she has no son, and her husband is old. So let's pause there. It's a fairly long story, and that's a place to take a respite and at least kind of set the rest of the stage. Rob, why don't you take it first?
Okay. So this is the famous Shunammite woman miracle. One day Elisha visited Shunam, and a well-to-do woman living there pressed him to stay and eat a meal. After this, whenever he came through, he stopped for the meal. She said to her husband, I can see that this is a holy man of Elohim who keeps stopping at our place. Please, let's build him a little room on the roof. We'll put a bed and a table in it for him, and a stool and a candle. Not a candlestick. It says candlestick in the translation, but I think that's talking about an oil lamp. And then whenever he comes to visit us, he can stay there. It was Elisha's custom to travel about all over the land of Israel in order to observe how the people lived, to help them when necessary, and to teach them the knowledge of Yahweh. One day he visited the town of Shunem, and there lived an aged couple there, and both of them were very kind and pious people. The woman of Shunem was particularly hospitable, and she saw to it that the prophet ate bread at her house. The aged couple were so pleased with the great privilege and mitzvah of haknesos orkin, or the hospitality, that they built a special room for him and put a bed there and a table and a lamp, so that whenever the prophet passed through Shunem, he would find a ready a place to stay. You know, this was before there were hotels in the land. Inns were a commonplace, but they were basically a room attached to a house, maybe two rooms attached to a house, that would be good for lodging. This, obviously, there's not a kind of places like that in this area to stay, and so Elisha always stopped by this house. And they want to make a permanent place for him when he comes through. And I think that's amazing that they want to show that kind of hokonosis or king or hospitality. In the Middle East, this is a commandment. And in fact, if you don't show hospitality, then you can be stoned. Remember the modern day story of the Rangers that were caught in Afghanistan, and a Afghani gave them hospitality. One of the men, the others had been killed. This man runs to the nearest house and goes in there, and the Afghani, though he had no love for Americans, had to give him hospitality. So when the Taliban came and asked for him to be surrendered to them so they could kill him, this Afghani refused. He said, I am bound, and you know this, our religion binds us to the fact that I have to show him hospitality because he's sought refuge at my home. And so they left him, and he's gone on to write a book about it and whatnot. And there's actually a movie that they've made now. So this sense of hospitality goes even beyond blood. That once someone is seeking hospitality from you in the Middle East, you must give it. To not do that would bring retribution upon you. And that's the same way here in Southeast Asia. There's that same sense of hospitality. You must show hospitality to the foreigner that comes in, because to not do that would bring bad fortune upon your family. So I think that is a you can see why that became the mainstay in the Bedouin regions, that where you're not sure where you're going to get water or food. So if you're traveling by foot or donkey across the way, there are no restaurants, there are no inns to be had. You're on the mercy of the people that live around about it.
Okay. Well, we've only got a few minutes left. Let's at least get a little bit more of the story, because she does the good deed, and of course there will be a reward at play here. So Gehazi says to the prophet, she hadn't got a son, and her husband is old. So the prophet says, call her. And when he called her, she stood in the doorway. And then he said, about this time next year, you shall embrace a son. And she said, no, Adoni, no, my lord, man of Elohim, do not lie to your maidservant. And how many times have we seen something like this? She doesn't laugh, okay, and they're not going to name the kid Yitzhak for laughter, but it does sound like a really familiar, it rhymes, I guess you'd say, when it comes to the story here. So don't be woofing me, she tells him. But the woman conceived, and she bore a son when the appointed time had come, of which Elisha had told her. And the child grew. So obviously we're talking several years down the line here. Now it happened one day that he went out to his father, to the reapers. And he said to his father, my head, my head. So he said to his servants, carry him to his mother. When he'd taken him and brought him to his mother, he sat on her knees until noon, and then he died. And she went up and laid him on the bed of the man of Elohim, the room that they had set aside for him, and shut the door upon him and went out. And then she said to her husband, please, send me one of the young men and one of the donkeys, that I may ride to the man of Elohim and come back. Well, he said, why are you going to go to him today? It's neither the new moon nor the Sabbath. And she said, well. Now, that's an interesting refrain, and there's a lot there, too. We'll probably have to pick some of this up next week. So she saddled a donkey, said to her servant, drive and go forward. Do not slacken the pace for me unless I tell you. So she basically, didn't spare the horses, or the donkey in this case, and she departed, went to the man of Elohim at Mount Carmel. And so it was when the man of Elohim, notice how often it keeps saying the man of Elohim rather than using his proper name at this point. I always find that kind of thing interesting. So it was when the man of Elohim saw her afar off, he said to his servant Gehazi, look, the Shunammite woman. Please now run to meet her and say to her, is it well with you? Well, she just said well before she left, didn't she? Is it well with you? Well with the child. And she answered, well. Now when she came to the man of God at the hill, she caught him by the feet, but Gehazi came near to push her away. The man of El said, let her alone, for her soul is in deep distress, and Yahuwah has hidden it from me and has not told me. So she now asks him, and this is kind of a poignant question, did I ask a son of my Lord? Did I not say, do not deceive me? And then he said to Gehazi, get yourself ready. Take my staff in your hand and be on your way. If you meet anyone, don't greet him. If anyone greets you, don't answer him. Just lay my staff on the face of the child. In other words, head him up, move him out, and hurry. And then the mother of the child said, as Yahuwah lives and as your soul lives, I will not leave you. So he arose and followed her. This woman is, I think, demonstrating some incredible faith here, among other things. Now, Gehazi went on ahead of them, and he laid the staff on the face of the child, but there was neither voice nor hearing. Therefore, he went back to meet him and told him, saying, the child has not awakened. When Elisha came into the house, there was a child lying dead on his bed. And I guess this is a good place to pause. We can at least talk about where we're at so far, and we'll pick it up probably next week with the miracle. MP, let me go to you first and see what you got in the way of comments, then we'll go to Rob.
Okay, well, back in verse 15, after she'd left them, and in verse 15 indicates that she needed to be called back. Elisha asked Gehazi what he thought could be done for her. And Gehazi mentioned that she was childless. And Elisha had him call her back. When she returned, Elisha told her that at this time next year, she would be holding a son in her arms. Now, her reply could be seen as unbelief, but the tenor of the passage tells me that she had been granted her most precious desire. The phrasing of the promise is very similar to the phrasing of Yehovah to Abraham at his tent door in Genesis 18 in verses 9 through 10, where Abraham said this, "And they said unto him, where is Sarah thy wife? And he said, behold, in the tent. And he said, I will certainly return to thee according to the time of life. And lo, Sarah thy wife shall have a son. And Sarah heard in the tent door, which was behind him." Now, Sarah's response was very similar to the Shunammite's, one of cautious, hopeful belief that sounds more like, you got to be kidding me, than you're a liar. Okay, they're not saying you're lying to me. She said, I can't believe what you're saying. This is so wonderful. Okay, Sarah's response was very similar to the Shunammite's, one of cautious, hopeful belief. Okay,
now don't kid me. Yeah,
but don't kid me exactly. And let's see, what kind of time we got? About 3 minutes. Sarah's response was very similar. She said this. Now, Abraham and Sarah were old and well-stricken in years, and it ceased to be with Sarah after the manner of women. Therefore, Sarah laughed within herself, saying, after I am waxed old, shall I have pleasure, my Lord being old also? And Jehovah said unto Abraham, wherefore did Sarah laugh, saying, shall I have of a surety bear a child, which am old? Is anything too hard for Jehovah? At the time appointed, I will return to thee according to the time of life. That's twice he's used that term. And Sarah shall have a son. Then Sarah denied, saying, I laugh not, for she said she was afraid. And he said, nay, but thou didst laugh. The fact that Sarah had already experienced menopause is cited. But the miraculous promise, spoken twice in verses 10 and 14, according to the time of life, chai, her dead post-menstrual womb, would be made alive, was that her body would once again be made able to conceive, and that she would bear Abraham. She had no desire. She had so desired a son that she had convinced Abraham to take Hagar as his wife and have her bear on Sarah's knees 13 years before. You can probably understand the unspoken response to the promise made under those circumstances. In a way, Sarah believed Yitzhak from the dead, received Yitzhak from the dead, even as Abraham would 37 years later. So the Shunammite woman in verse 8, the only other place in KJV where the words great and woman occur in order, though reversed, is in Matthew chapter 15 and verses 22 to 28, where the woman of Canaan came out of the same coast and cried unto him, saying, have mercy on me, Adonai, son of David. My daughter is grievously vexed with the devil, but he answered her not a word. Okay. O woman, here's what he said. O woman, great is thy faith. Be it unto thee even as thou wilt. And her daughter was made whole from the very hour. I quote that here because the Shunammite woman exercised the same kind of faith in the man of Elohah and as Sarah did in Yehovah in her tent door, as this Canaanite woman did with the son of David.
Okay. Well, and that's a good place to stop because basically we're seeing a story of faith, and we'll pick it up next week with the rest of this because this woman accepts the son, then goes back and does something that I think we see over and over again when it comes to prayers, and that is to remind either the prophet in this case or when we see prophets or other men of Yah literally reminding him of his promises. She starts that way. That too is an act of faith. And the entire rest of the story, as far as what they do hereafter, is an act of faith as well. And it also is one of the greatest and certainly prophetic in terms of other things to come, miracles in Scripture. So we'll leave it there. We'll pick it up next week as we continue Chapter 4 of 2 Kings. Thanks, guys. Shalom, folks. Amen.